Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, MacGuffinMan.com, for all of our previous 283 podcasts. We most recently talked about 3 Days of the Condor. Before that was Out of Sight, and before that was LA Confidential. I've also recently written about The Lost City of Zed, Terrence Malick's most recent film, Song to Song, and Master of None. And I'm writing something about Kimmy Schmidt. That will be up soon enough. So yeah, you can check those things out. You can follow us on Twitter, at The MacGuffin Man. And that's about it. Let's get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Hoorah.
Unwrap that clawed hand from your notes and tell me what we're talking about here today.
I put the mic into the claw. That's how I got around that. We're talking about War Machine.
Yes.
The latest Brad Pitt film.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I feel like a lot of people are talking about it right now. It's it was released on Netflix, kind of one of the big first, big movie star in Brad Pitt, obviously, is releasing his movie there. And I guess it did have very limited theatrical release, but it's kind of being discussed as a transitional moment as much as it is about the movie itself right now. So there's a lot of people talking about it. Obviously, we're going to be the brightest and most insightful people talking about it. But
This will be Brad Pitt will call into the podcast next week and say this is the definitive conversation about War Machine.
That's right.
So we welcome your calls, Brad.
Yes.
Yeah. but yes, you are right. Like there was the Beasts of No Nation is the first Netflix movie, I believe. And then there was the who knows how many Adam Sandler movies that I have ignored since then, amongst other things. I think there's some kids programming that never would have crossed my radar. But yeah, this is the first of their real movie star sort of forays. It's like this is the movie equivalent of House of Cards. You know, like there were TV shows that Netflix made before House of Cards, but House of Cards was the first one where they're like, we've got David Fincher and Kevin Spacey now, you know, and Netflix is now like, we've got Brad Pitt. Later in the year, they'll say we've got Will Smith, you know.
So. Yeah, and House of Cards is a good example, and it was, as you said, it wasn't the first one, but it was one with stars involved. It was critically well received. From what I can gather, as I said, I mean, there's a lot of people talking about War Machine. It does not seem as immediately well regarded as House of Cards was, but it's still sort of it's sort of a movie of the moment in a lot of ways beyond the content of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a very sort of insular way, the people that have been talking about it are the people that were always going to talk about it, the people like you and I who are interested in these sorts of things. I haven't found anybody other than me and I suppose you that has seen this movie that I can actually talk to in my life. And even more than that, like I've just straight up found it difficult to find somebody that knows this movie exists. Even Netflix doesn't seem to be pushing it very hard when you're on Netflix. Like when you type in war and first of all, it's not easily accessible on the home screen. Second of all, when I typed in war in the search bar, War Machine was not the first movie to come up. I don't remember what was, but that was baffling to me. So yeah, I don't know. It's just, it feels weird to me, but
yeah, no, I felt the same thing, and you're right. It's not, a huge cultural moment where everyone you know is talking about it, that's for sure. I just within the industry, you know, people whose jobs are you know, rely on Hollywood or filmmaking in any capacity, whether it's making films or working on films or you know, reviewing it, talking about films, it's just kind of the canary in the coal mine. Maybe that's putting it a little too pessimistically, but it's more of a bellwether movie than a lot of things that have come to this point.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So now that you have someone you can actually talk about this movie with, and I'm sure we'll talk more about you know, some of the more of that inside baseball stuff in a bit. But
oh yeah, for sure. But I think you and I both would prefer to talk about the movie first and then and then the influence of it after, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and I do think that there are a couple interesting connections in a meta sense between Netflix and sort of what this movie is. But I think starting with just the movie itself would be the wisest place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Brad Pitt's fantastic. This movie's up and down very much. There's a real tonal inconsistency to it, I would say. And I have a lot of problems with the voiceover narration. But
a voice scoot.
I know it's your voice scoot. I also have a real problem with him, his loose tie when he finally shows up in the movie. It's like, we get it. You're a fucking writer. You're telling us you're a writer. You don't also have to have a loosened tie. Like, it's that's so hacky to me. But
his shirt. His shirt sucks too. Like,
yeah, I think I was too busy rolling my eyes the second I got down to that tie knot. I didn't make it to the shirt. But I mean, I enjoy this movie. Like, it's a good movie, and it has a lot of actors I appreciate in surprisingly small roles a lot of the time. But it also has Brad Pitt in a very large role, and I appreciate Brad Pitt, and I think he gives a performance that kind of only Brad Pitt could give, for better and for worse. But yeah, the movie's not fantastic, but I certainly enjoyed it. You know. I think it's like this is David Michaud's third film. I think it's his worst movie, but that's, I mean, Animal Kingdom is fantastic and The Rover is pretty good. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The tonal shift thing is the biggest criticism that I'm coming across as well.
Yeah. Which I think is a very valid criticism. It's kind of like the movie. And the other thing that I don't quite get is the perspective that the movie's supposed to be holding. Just sort of jumps around, and I guess that's tied in with the tone, but just it feels like Brad Pitt and Lakeith Stanfield are in totally different movies, despite the fact that they are sometimes in the same scene
speaking to each other.
I
feel like that's right. I did enjoy this movie too, and I get the inconsistency of tone, and I don't know if I just kind of bought into this movie and I accept it the way that sometimes you do with something that you're on the fence about, but I think it works. I think it works with the subject matter. I mean, anything that's inconsistent, you know, it sounds like it's bad. You know, there's a certain incompleteness to the vision of what you're going for. But I mean, aren't there movies that are confusing and mean to be confusing, and even if that doesn't provide a satisfying film going experience kind of straight down the middle, there still is something to gain from that, you know. It's and I'm not saying that this movie's confusing necessarily, but I do think that it's inconsistent, and I think it might feel inconsistent for a reason. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And certainly that is something I would say to a movie that's totally inconsistent, that you know, that where I'm sort of on your side of the argument, where those inconsistencies don't bother me, where they do in this movie. You know, like, I understand that it could feel inconsistent on purpose, but I just sort of feel like that it doesn't totally work. Like, I don't know, and it's a hard thing to explain, but I guess the thing that really bothers me about this movie, that I think can be tied into the tone, is that the Scoot McNairy voiceover that carries throughout the very beginning in the first 15 minutes of this movie. I suggested this idea for the podcast before I'd seen the movie. Then the first 15 minutes, I was like, oh no, this might have been a real mistake. and then when Scoot actually shows up, I was like, cool. Like, the voiceover and the story are meeting, and hopefully the voiceover is gone now that we've sort of had all the ground laid, right? And then you sort of get to the end, and Scoot comes back and gives you the button on the end. And that really annoyed me. I really didn't like that post the Rolling Stone article coming out that we had the return of the narrator. That's one of the main things about this movie that really killed it for me, especially in the closing moments. It's just that it felt like we had moved closer towards McMahon's actual perspective, like gotten away from the outsider's perspective, gotten closer in. And then this character that is now totally removed from this situation, that is now writing another story about I don't know, Katy Perry or whatever, for Rolling Stone, like that voice comes back at the end for five sentences really bothered me. And I feel like that's the tonal inconsistency thing that I can't quite get past in my head, is that it feels like the movie is undecided about which perspective it wants to tell the story from. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and maybe couldn't think of a way to finish it off without going back to that crutch.
Yeah, especially like the very beginning, the voiceover is annoying, but once you sort of realize that it's coming from somebody that shows up in the movie, like I sort of forgave the beginning stuff. But when it comes back at the end, that is when it... Because I don't think voiceover is lazy as a crutch just in general. I think voiceover can be done really well. But at the end, that's where it feels like it's a crutch, you know, and it really bothered me. It's like they couldn't figure, or Michaud couldn't figure out a way to make a scene where McMahon actually gives his opinion on where he is now, you know?
Right. Yeah, and after you've met the character, for him to kind of revert back to a voiceover, it sounds like you have the problem with.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, when I rewatched this movie, I was surprised by how much, like, the first maybe almost 20 minutes, definitely, or probably 15, is set up. Like, the music doesn't stop, and we just keep getting introduced to characters and the voiceover. And I know 15 minutes isn't a crazy amount of time to, you know, set up the pieces of your movie, but it's just one very long intro that they kind of spoon feed you, and I didn't really realize that on the first way through how long that really lasts for.
I could tell you that I did, but yeah, it did, and on the second viewing it bothered me much less the beginning, you know, because I knew where it was going, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we definitely need to continuing our connection of our trend of connecting movies from to the other. Yeah. This one continues with our Robert Redford to Brad Pitt. Mm-hmm. Brad Pitt's just such a big part of this in so many ways. You know, when we were talking about why this is important to Netflix, because he's involved, he produced it. You know, he's, from the interviews I've listened to, he's been in contact with Michaud since even Animal Kingdom came out. He saw mm-hmm. some shorts. And, you know, it's just been in constant contact with him. So this isn't just a movie that kind of showed up on his desk and he agreed to. This is something he's had a very big part of a long time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that tends to be the way that a lot of these Plan B produced movies, Brad Pitt's production company Plan B, with Dede Gardner and Jeremy Kline, I think, how a lot of these things end up happening is that, you know, Brad Pitt and Gardner and Kline, they just all seem to have good taste in movies. Like, if you look at the movies that Plan B works on in some capacity, it's a pretty good list, you know? And even the ones that I don't love, like, you can sort of see the what could have attracted them to it. And this one, David Michaud is somebody that seemed to have been on the radar, not unlike James Gray had been, where... The Lost City of Zed came out about a month ago, and that was a Plan B production as well. And the genesis of that movie is Plan B sending James Gray the book David Grann had written about The Lost City of Zed. And that's pretty much what happened with David Michaud and War Machine as well, is that he got sent the book and it just sort of happened to catch his interest, you know, and got sent the book by Plan B. So yeah, yes. It's...
Scoot McNairy's character in this wrote a book, you know, extrapolating the article that he writes for Rolling Stone.
Yeah, exactly.
And that book's called The Operators. His name is Michael Hastings. And yeah, that got to Brad Pitt, or somebody at Plan B eventually, and to Brad Pitt.
Yeah. And I think the way that they have sort of done this, and this is the same with James Gray, is that they just sort of kept sending... They found these filmmakers that they wanted to work with and kept sending material like, maybe this is the one that will sort of catch their eye. And I would assume other people do this all the time with people that they want to work with. But I just know these specific examples. And so I think they just sort of saw something in David Michaud, and I don't think incorrectly, because I think Animal Kingdom is a really good movie. And Brad Pitt wouldn't necessarily end up working on this movie without seeing a script, but once the script was finished by Michaud, it sounds like Brad Pitt was pretty on board pretty much immediately.
Right.
Yeah.
So very central into, you know, developing this with Plan B and Michaud. And, you know, not only is he the undisputed star of this film, he's a big part of it, but he's also just a big character in this one. Like, this is very much a performance for Brad Pitt, not exactly playing himself again, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, this, his whole performance is
a series of choices.
Yeah, no, exactly. He's not doing his Billy Bean performance in Moneyball. He's doing that 1 second in Moneyball where Billy Bean does the Popeye walk, but he's doing the Popeye walk for the whole movie. You know what I mean?
And it's a Popeye face.
Oh, so much Popeye face, Popeye claw, everything. That classic Popeye claw.
Throw a can of spinach in that claw and you're there.
Yeah. No, it is a big performance. And I think one of the things that I've sort of come to appreciate about Brad Pitt over the years is that he kind of wishes he was a character actor, but he's so goddamn famous that he just can never be that. But that doesn't stop him from being a character actor in movie star roles. And that I think is the best way to sort of figure. He's playing this character like he's a supporting character in a Coen Brothers movie, but he is he is the lead in this movie, you know? And I think that's wonderful. I think something I really love about his performance is that you can never really tell what he's thinking. You can never tell what we're supposed to think about McMahon, which I think is part of the point of the movie. And I really enjoy that about Brad Pitt's performance. And it's just also incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, no, it's really fun. And then I've seen some people criticize him, saying, you know, you don't know if you're supposed to sympathize with him or you're supposed to judge him. And, you know, they tie that into the tonal inconsistency of the film. You know, they don't know how to think about this protagonist. And that just doesn't really fly with me. Like, I think that's one of the strengths of this, that you laugh with them, but then you kind of laugh at him. And I think that gray area is a lot of the value of this movie, is that it's hard to peg down, and not because the character's inconsistent, but because, you know, people are ambiguous. And I think this depicts him as somewhat ambiguous. I think this depicts the American effort in Afghanistan as pretty ambiguous. And I like that. You know, there are some things about this movie we'll get to that I think were we'll say predictable, or that we've seen before, but I think it offers a lot of stuff that we haven't, that we still kind of wrestle with throughout the whole movie, or at least I found that I did, and I thought that was a strength, not something that detracted from my enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely as it pertains to McMahon himself. It's just some of the aspects outside of McMahon's character in this movie don't really connect in a way that I found worked. But as far as, like, not understanding what we're supposed to think about McMahon throughout the movie, that's, I think, this movie's number one strength, you know?
Yeah, because, like, when you first see him, you know, with the kind of the blonde hair that's always perfectly coiffed, I guess part of the military thing, like, he looks like a grizzled Ken doll, you know what I mean? Like, when that grew up, like, he's still, like, it's still Brad Pitt, he's still got, like, the square jaw and everything, but you know, he's got the eyebrow and the one kind of semi-squinted eye all the time, and an inability to smile, it seems, when he's asked to smile for the camera. And I don't know, I really like it. I think it's obviously a lot of big choices, and it could come off as super goofy. And maybe it definitely does.
Yeah.
No, but I think it's a movie that I think is about disconnects and ambiguity, and definitely also about transition. I think it's I think it works. I mean, I'm a Brad Pitt fan as well, but
yeah.
People kind of look at this as an example of one of the bigger problems of this movie, is that, you know, the tone shifts too much, the story doesn't make sense. But I'm with you. Like, I think that there is that shift, there is that ambiguity to his character, and I find that works even in the spots when the narrative similarities to that don't work that well.
Yeah, agreed entirely.
Okay, cool, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, at no point in this movie is Brad Pitt or McMahon or the characterization of McMahon my problem with it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and he's got a little bit of, like, the Aldo Rain, like his character from Glorious Bastards, to it.
And there's a little bit of
and everybody loved that. So yeah. I don't know why Everyone's so upset.
Well, I mean, because everybody in that movie was acting like they were in a Tarantino movie, whereas only Brad Pitt seems to be acting like he's, and a little bit of Ben Kingsley is acting like he's in a Tarantino movie in this, you know?
Maybe Anthony Michael Hall.
Yeah. I think he's acting like he's in a Community episode, but
that's true.
Yeah. But no, I think that, I mean, that's the big difference between Aldo Raine and this. But I see a little bit of his Burn After Reading character as well.
Yeah. And I mean, just because I wasn't going to bring up Quentin Tarantino, you know, everyone like the acting style you find in there. But I find his movies will go from straight comedy to drama to violence to satire comedy to total bummer pretty quickly. And people talk about how, you know, Quentin Tarantino has a consistent tone, even though there's all those things within it. I don't know why this doesn't work for that as well.
Because Tarantino, it's like, there's a reason something would be called Tarantino-esque as opposed to Michaud-esque, you know? Like, there is no term Michaud-esque, you know? Whereas with Tarantino, that's exactly what you're talking about, is the tonal consistency. That's what makes it something, a Tarantino sort of style of movie, is that he throws all of these disparate things into a blender, and then what comes out is the Tarantino style. You know what I mean? And there's just such a there's a much more consistency and a defined style in the filmmaking of it as well. Whereas this War Machine looks like other movies, whereas Tarantino movies kind of only look like Tarantino movies, or all of the movies he's referencing inside of his Tarantino movie. But yeah. But I understand what you mean, because yes.
Like violence and comedy and
yeah,
drama.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a way that mix works together in a Tarantino movie that just doesn't in this. And I think it's because more of the actors are on the same page. I think that's a big part of it.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. He's got more of a high-powered blender that makes everything smooth when it's all combined.
Yeah, exactly. He watches the most late-night blender commercials, so he's able to find the real cream of the crop.
Yeah. You mentioned the look of it. How is this visually stack up for you?
It's relatively boring. The stuff that is well done is the stuff later in the movie with where Lakeith Stanfield's character is ends up killing a child. That's the stuff where Michaud's sort of more in his element, like. The things that are Animal Kingdom and The Rover are both more action movies than this one is. And that's where you can sort of see his talent is he is a good action director. And this is just tonally an entirely new type of movie for Michaud. So I think part of it is just sort of this is new to him. And, you know, he didn't want to get too experimental because he wanted to make sure the scenes actually worked. You know, that's my guess. I don't have any sort of he would never say, oh, we kept the visual look boring because I was scared, you know. He would never say that, but yeah. that's sort of how I feel about it. It's a nice looking movie for sure, but not anything where there are a few shots that stick out at me where I'm just like, ooh, that was a gorgeous shot, you know.
Yeah I get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty, filmmaking wise, it's a pretty utilitarian movie.
Okay. Yeah, and so you really liked his first two movies, right?
I really liked Animal Kingdom and I liked The Rover, yeah.
Okay. And, I mean, thematically, is this something that you would see coming from him, or is it... Because, I mean, I listened to some interviews with him. It's obviously a departure, and he tried to make it a bit like that, but didn't want to... Like, he was saying he didn't want to just make it a horror movie. Yeah. But that he couldn't really tell an Afghanistan war story without that being part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But do you see, you know, his fingerprints on this otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, the things where, I mean, again, that scene with, especially where Lakeith Stanfield goes rogue, sort of, and he just sort of runs away from the rest of the team. Cole is his name. That's when it sort of really felt more like Michaud's previous movies, with that sort of longish take that follows him. Because that's sort of Animal Kingdom and The Rover are both, movies with a lot of space in between dialogue and a lot of good tension built up, and then quick bursts of action, which is exactly what happens in that scene, whereas the rest of it is pretty foreign to Michaud as I have come to know him. You know?
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
So I suspect he would do better with with another attempt at satire. You know?
Okay. Yeah.
I do think he's a sharp guy, and I just think that I feel like he can probably see some of the problems with this movie and would like a do-over himself.
You don't think he'd be happy with it?
I'm sure he's happy with it, but also I would imagine to be this good at anything, you have to be looking at your finished product and kind of only be seeing flaws, you know?
Yeah.
So that you can improve.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's something that I think is ingrained in most directors of this level or higher, is that you just have to be willing enough to see exclusively your mistakes so that you can get better at it.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because it's a really, really hard job.
Yeah. What do you think the title War Machine means? Like, why that choice?
They were trying to get the Marvel fans. They wanted to think maybe Don Cheadle's in this movie. No, I mean, the beginning and ending is sort of just is really where that sort of becomes apparent the most, is that, you know, somebody gets fired so that McMahon comes in, and then McMahon gets fired so that Russell Crowe comes in, you know? And, that's the machine, is that these things just keep going around and around in circles, and we see a lot of the mechanics of the machine, you know, Alan Ruck's character, that guy Dick with the Skype issues.
Dick Waddle, all-time great name. And I've always been an Alan Ruck fan. I thought he was great in this.
Alan Ruck,
there's a lot of like good small parts of this, and I would number that among them.
Alan Ruck's good in everything. It has been since Ferris Bueller. Multiple John Hughes alums in this movie as well, but
yeah, that's true.
But yeah, that line where he's talking about, you know, that one was, that was pithy, but it was also true. Like that line's great. I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
No, just the War Machine title.
Oh yeah, and there's sort of different mechanisms of the machine, but the idea that the movie wants us to leave with is that McMahon might be able to learn something, but he's just a cog in the machine. And by the time he is able to get to a point where he learns something about the world that he's in, somebody else has to come in and relearn that entire world. He has to go through the opening 30 minutes again where McMahon was just doing his tour, you know, and just trying to learn and gather intel.
Yeah, and you think a title like War Machine, you kind of think like in not a morally positive way, but at least it strikes you as an efficient title, or, you know, a machine that's at least good at its job. But this seems to depict it as something that's almost a self-defeating machine, like the useless machine in Fargo. But it's this apparatus that has, like, it's pulling in so many directions at the same time that it's bound to fail. And yeah, I think the bookends of this movie, you know, it starts with when I'm paraphrasing, but something like when the war becomes impossible to win in any meaningful sense, what do you do? Well, you sack the guy not winning the war and you bring in a new guy, mm-hmm. which that sentence is just entirely self-defeating, right? You know, it's you're saying that the war can't be won, so you just bring in another person that doesn't make the war winnable. It's just, mm-hmm. it's this machine that, it plugs along, you know, it continues to function, but it doesn't ever achieve the goal the way that, you know, you design a machine to achieve a goal, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think what you're talking about pairs well with, like, the thing that I like the most about this movie is that, you know, after Cole kills a child and McMahon's coming to the site, they're giving money to the parent of that child, and McMahon is finally sort of seeing what these actions can sort of do to people, do to families. And I think that's sort of the one time where we start to see McMahon showing some form of emotion in any capacity, and that it does sort of feel like as he's in the helicopter flying away, and him and Cole have just had this eye contact where they're both sort of just looking at each other, and you're supposed to think, at least that's my reading, you're supposed to think that they both have new views on how they viewed this war. And Cole was somebody that just wanted to be in action, and Now that he has been in action, he's just kind of, you can tell he's kind of shattered by it because of what he has done now. And then you see McMahon as he's flying away. It seems like he's starting to realize what he has done is, you know, in leading these people is that, you know, he's creating some of these things even from afar, and he's starting to sort of having his qualms with what he's doing. And right as he's getting past the hubris that we have spent so much time learning about and being shown, being told about by Scoot McNairy, he pretty much immediately is fired. Like, he goes to bed that night. He does read the same book that he was reading about excellence in management or whatever. But he's woken up like an hour and a half later, and he's reads the Rolling Stone article. You know, it's like as soon as he is able to get through his own shit and learn enough to actually view Afghanistan for the situation that it is, he gets taken out of the machine entirely.
Yeah, the cogs replaced. Yeah,
and that's something that I liked about this movie a lot, is that it's not that this war is necessarily unwinnable. It's just that by the time, or not even unwinnable, but ununderstandable, by the time one person does understand it, they get replaced. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good idea. And
then Scoot's voice comes in, and I'm just like, fuck, you ruined everything.
I like this movie for 8 seconds in a row, and then you stole it from me.
No, I do like this movie. It sounds like I'm being negative. The things that bother me about this movie really do bother me, but on a whole, it's a very enjoyable watch.
And it's too bad they had to make that Scoot. Yeah, well, because, I mean, that brings up something I was going to ask you anyway that I think you you half answered there. And it's about, if anybody, but most importantly, Glenn, because the Glenimal. awful nickname. If they have an arc in this movie. And you kind of, as I said, you kind of answered that question about he and Cole, if he has an arc, if, you know, he's any different than he was at the beginning of the movie. And I think I agree almost entirely with your assessment of his arc. But do you think that is just, you know, a linear progression of someone being involved in the military, but, you know, kind of any big endeavor? Or do you think it's something about him being sort of a relic of a past and the world changing in such a way, not just him traveling through it, but this being a different time? You know, we kind of get him aligned with World War II. You know, they talk about his hand being in the shape of a claw to smoke a big World War II cigar. We kind of see him function really well in old Europe, which obviously brings us back to World War II, and, you know, they've all got their fancy military outfits on, and he's very assertive and good at what he does. And when he's telling Tom Howard there to get, you know, leave the table and stuff like that, and everyone's being very chivalrous to his wife and things like that. And when we see him in this very old world setting at this, you know, old fancy dinner, and he seems to fit in quite well. So I didn't know if you thought, you know, Afghanistan's an entirely different war. It's such a different thing from World War II that he's a relic from the past, or is this just more of a linear progression of anybody getting older and finding things different than when they were young?
I think it's also sort of a power/powerless thing, where in those scenes that you're describing in Europe, he can really feel his own power. You know, the dinner that they're at is like kind of for him in some capacity.
No, it's for Afghanistan.
Yeah, no, I know. But, but he is, that's a place where he is very much like everybody sees his rank and respects it, you know? So he has more power there than he does in that scene towards the end where he flies away from Cole. That's sort of where he realizes how powerless he is, you know? And he cares so much about, or seems to care so much. Again, the gray area is always interesting with McMahon, but he seems to care about feeling some sort of power, like, or feeling like he has had some effect on his world, you know, just the way that he walks into command center office, I don't know, at the beginning, and just sort of rearranges how everything, it makes it much more open concept. You know, that's him putting his stamp on things.
Yeah.
And, you know, he likes to feel like he's affecting the world that he's in. And then he gets out to this other part of the world that he is in, you know, another part of the country that he's in, and sees that he really has had no effect. If anything, the effect that he has had has made it worse, you know. So I think it's a difference between him being in a situation where he feels his own power, feels his power and his rank within the military, and situations where, even though his rank is still respected among these soldiers and he's still seen as the leader of this group, he realizes that that means nothing, you know?
Yeah, and there's still things that are out of his control. Like, this is... this new kind of conflict is a lot harder to fight in, and even though he's at the top, the divisions between enemy and teammate are a lot different than some of the, like, than World War II, than even then in Iraq, you know, the place that he had been previously. It's still that much trickier and so much more gray area.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's true too, and I like the, I don't know, I think that there's a lot of good stuff about transition and translation in this movie. I think even in that closing scene when he's explaining to the group of people, not the very closing scene, but when he's explaining to the group of the Afghanistan people, and not necessarily just the father but that whole group that they show, as he's speaking to them and then he has the translator, you know, communicate what he said to them in their language, they kind of start and stop, and he gestures with his hand, and then he starts to put his hand away, and then the guy is translating and starts pointing at his hand. He realized that he's got to put his hand back out again. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's several little things like that I thought made a really good understated, and there's some overstated things in this movie, but I thought there's a lot of good understated things like that. Just the idea of transition and translation that he clearly isn't so good at, mm-hmm. and that get played out in good visual ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and as I said, I think this movie is being talked about in that industry sense, and you know, to look at this as a transition from the theater model to Netflix, mm-hmm. from and then even we have Brad Pitt as being what I think will be seen as one of the last real movie stars. Like, I think the term movie star is always going to be around, but we've been talking about the death of the movie stars for a few decades now, but he's still definitely existed in that world, you know, as a big movie star in the 90s when a movie star really meant a lot, and that's gone. I touched on it a bit earlier, but he's kind of the new Robert Redford as well. We have that transition, the transition we've already touched on a bit between World War II and modern wars, I like. And this whole, I mean, so much of this movie is about this transition from an occupied Afghanistan to a free Afghanistan, you know, one where they don't have to occupy it anymore. That's, you know, explicitly stated as that is why he's in there, to really put an end to this war and kind of close a chapter on that version of Afghanistan, get these free elections going. And the transition is clearly not smooth, and that's what the 2 hours of this film depict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Do you want to talk about your girl Tilda?
I mean, why is she in this movie? Like, I'd love it. Love that she's here. I just feel like she's got better things to do. She's Tilda. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. You seem to ask me this question a lot about small roles and people who are obviously very talented and taking roles that don't require 100% of their effort and mm-hmm. don't give them a ton of screen time. Mm-hmm. I think we're safe to say we're both Tilda Swinton fans.
Yeah. Who isn't it? Find me somebody that isn't.
Someone who's uncomfortable by people being as weird as they can possibly be, and maybe that's not a Tilda Swinton fan, but those people don't really have a good opinion.
they can't.
No, I think it is a political movie in a lot of ways. I think I think people want to be seen on what they feel is the right side of an issue. I think she got to do an accent, which she probably enjoys doing. And she really, I mean, if you want to be in a political movie because you want to have your, be associated with a certain idea, mm-hmm. functioning as the clearest, most explicit mouthpiece of what this movie is about, mm-hmm. Really drives that home. I mean, her questions are really... extrapolating some of the most basic ideas in this movie. So if you want to be in something for that reason, I think this is a good role to take.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Also, she got paid to do this. That's another reason.
Well, yeah, she got paid and she didn't have to do a lot of work for it, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure she spent a lot of time working on her accent, though.
You know what? I bet she didn't. No. I bet she's just got that in the bag.
She's just that good.
She's Tilda, man.
Yeah. Well, were you surprised at all by the nature of her questions? Just that, you know, this seems so anti... At sometimes, at least, you know, as we said, this movie goes back and forth on a lot of things. It seems so anti-militaristic in a lot of ways and anti-imperialist in a lot of ways. And her questions are about, you know, she says, I believe you're a good man. I think your intentions are correct. Would you expect that to be a bit more negative than that?
Like, just in the way that she's sort of... you know, she's not interrogative, basically. She's It's the all due respect form of questioning, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, I just think that she, where she's coming, yes, you are right that the tone of her question is different from let's say Green Zone, where people yell things at the camera a lot about how democracy should work and all these things. Whereas she's just sort of, her character is accepting and understanding of the fact that, people are human beings that deserve respect, and also she realizes that McMahon is in a very difficult position, like his job is difficult, you know, and I think she's respectful of that, but she also just sees the thing that put him there, that put him in that job, as fundamentally flawed, you know, and she just sort of feels she needs to get that out there.
Yeah, that makes sense, and I kind of look at it as, you know, this movie is depicting a time a few years in the past, but not distant past. And it strikes me as sort of the end of American exceptionalism and the end of America as no longer the lone superpower in the world. Like, mm-hmm. even if what you're doing is right, you can't do it on your own. You know, she says, I just want to make sure your personal ambitions are not delusional and yeah. don't carry a cost for everybody. Just this idea that even if you are doing the right thing as a nation, you know, which you can argue, but even if you are doing the right thing, to do it unilaterally, to do all of this on your own, it might impact the rest of the world. And I think that that's something Brad Pitt and, you know, as we discussed, Robert Redford probably believes. Like, America can have its heart in the right place, but as its military might diminishes and the world gets a lot more complicated, just having your heart in the right place isn't the be-all to end-all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way I took her line of questioning, and as a bit more positive than just, you can't do that, you're a bad person. It's, even if you are a good person, even if we believe these American ideals are good for the world at large, you can't do it like this. This isn't the way to spread liberal values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree.
Okay.
Yeah. And then she sang a David Bowie song, and she sang Starman, and everybody was happy.
That's right.
Yeah. That's in the deleted scenes that Netflix will never let us see.
Damn Netflix.
The devil. Damn you, Ted Sarandos. That's his name, right?
I don't know.
Yeah. Topher Grace is in this movie and is fantastic. I feel like that needs to be mentioned. Very small role, but his introduction is...
Oh, I don't know. Is he a good actor? Straight flush. Okay, I gotta take this. Oh, what an absolute monster.
Yeah, no, he's great. Do you have anything else about the movie before we move on to the Netflix side of things?
No, just that I think parts of it are very, very funny.
I mean, the heroin growing scene is amazing. I love that scene.
Yeah, that's good.
All due respect, which we alluded to. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Room 517, I thought that was good too. And I just think Meg Tilly, his wife, is great in this.
Yes.
And considering he still is the same character, I think the few minutes of work she gets to do really help ground it.
Yes, I agree.
His character as just a person and a family man and a husband. I, you know, as I watched it again, I realized how little screen time she has. But I think, like, pound for pound, it does a lot to really bring this movie into a personal level that actually works on an emotional scale.
Yeah, exactly, because she's the connection to home, right? So she's the connection to us, basically, the other side, or the another continent that is fighting this war, but just, you know, on the other side of the world, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, she is us visiting this new world, basically. And that is very important to people like yourself and I who have not been in war.
And never will be.
Fingers crossed. You never know. I would do terribly.
Can you fix an electric razor and fake that Skype is not working? That might be your niche.
I can definitely fake that Skype's not working. That also, one thing I do want to point out, Dick Waddle, even when the Skype call is working, the framing of his Skype camera is so perfect, where he's just like this tiny head and there's so much negative space. It's such a good representation of old person not totally understanding how to work technology and gets it to a point. It's like, fuck it, I'm on screen. Who cares about the composition, you know?
Yes. I wholeheartedly.
Yeah. So I really appreciated that. But okay. So Netflix, right? Because
Netflix.
I have a very old man sort of feeling about this, and just that I simultaneously understand the way that this is the way the world is moving, and I also understand that it's a direction I don't love, in that, like, the Netflix offers their movies to movie theaters, but movie theaters won't show them because they basically feel like it's a wasted screen because it's also available on Netflix, you know? Yeah. And just selfishly, because that's how I prefer to watch movies, like, that bums me out. I know, like, the next Martin Scorsese movie probably isn't going to play in theaters, which feels weird. Sorry, I shouldn't say probably. I feel like it will actually play in theaters. I think they're going to find something out about how Hollywood is reacting to them over the next year and a half that they kind of have to figure out a sort of workaround between the theatrical release window, or to allow their movies to play in theaters, just because I think there's going to be a real old world approach to sort of rejecting Netflix, and, you know, the importance of the theatrical distribution in some capacity. Like, you've seen it a little bit with Khan, with Pedro Almodovar saying that he just wouldn't give the Palme d'Or to Bong Joon-hong. I forget his name, I'm sorry. Okja is the movie. Just because it's Netflix and it's not going to be a theatrically released movie. And there's going to continue to be bounce back about that. And I just sort of feel like there's going to have to be some sort of middle ground that Netflix finds. And the thing that also really bothers me about Netflix is, I mentioned this in an email, the Netflix production logo really bugs me, but the Plan B logo I love. And they play back to back in this movie, where it's just like the Netflix, the da-da sound, and just the name Netflix. And then Plan B just shows up on screen after that. And the thing that bugs me about the Netflix logo is it's just like, fuck it, Netflix. You know, it's just sort of like, this is our name, whatever, let's get out of here. There's no rhyme or reason to why we're doing this. Say Amazon Studios, which is their closest competitor, right?
Yeah.
That's just, like, just, sorry.
I just know you love that one.
And no, it's great.
It's very entertaining, yeah.
It's the building of a movie theater in a home. Like, it's actually sort of showing what Amazon is doing. And Plan B, despite being basically the same thing as Netflix, minus the sound and a different logo, Plan B, it's like implying that our first option didn't work, and this is just what we have to go with. I've always really liked that as a production logo. It's just like, because I think that says a lot about filmmaking in general, is that Plan A never works. So sometimes you're stuck with a less appealing Plan B. And the thing that really bothers me about Netflix and the way that this movie has sort of shown up on Netflix is that it's kind of like the logo. It's just like, it's there, you know, like, it's there now. And that sort of feels like why a lot of the reason behind why they have or are making all these things is just to be like, it's here, you know. It doesn't matter, it doesn't really matter what it is or who sees it, just that it's on here for people to see eventually, you know. And that's also my own inferences, you know. Yeah, but it's just sort of, I don't know, I just think it's it just feels odd to me that that it just sort of appears and then it's just gone, you know.
Yeah, no, I love the contrast of these two because of how similar they are and how different they are. I find the And by these two, I mean the Netflix and the Plan B logos. I guess title cards. I don't know what you call this.
Production logos, I think. Is the...
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, no. For me, the how short and how bright the Netflix thing is. Like, I think that bright red has this urgency and this primacy to it. Like, it's just like, this is it, as you said. Like, boom. It burns your retinas. Like, there's just no denying how big and powerful this company is right now. And it says that in a short, bright little burst and has the sound effect. And then we contrast that with Plan B, which, as you said, like, it's black and white and silent. You legit could have made this logo 100 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, it has this very old world, like, silent film, black and white, just understated presence to it. And yeah, as you said in that email, they're very similar in so many ways, but even just like that, just those small things to me really say a lot about the two companies. And the Netflix, you know, we talked about Plan B working with these guys, working with these directors for years and years, like trying to find the perfect project. Oh, this doesn't work. Okay, we'll come back in 2 years. We'll mail you a book. And if that doesn't work, like, we'll keep you around for a decade and just bounce ideas off each other until it's perfect. And then there was that story of Netflix maybe a month or two ago now that said, our competition isn't Hulu and Amazon, it's sleep. Like, it's we're not losing out on people to our competitors. We're losing out on these, like, biological features of humanity. And, like, that's something so hyper futuristic and so forward to me. And I think the having those back to back in this and your question about it really drove that difference home for me.
Do you think that's why Glenn McMahon only sleeps 4 hours a night because of Netflix?
That might be it.
No, and one thing, you know, to say positive things about Netflix, I mean, two of my favorite TV shows are on Netflix, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is a show that just wouldn't exist without Netflix because NBC didn't pick it up. They just didn't want the show, which is insane to me because that show is amazing. That and Master of None, you know, Master of None was shopped to all of the traditional networks like HBO and all that stuff. And nobody would let that be made with the amount of freedom that Netflix did, right? And the result is a fantastic television show that I adore. And the same to an extent with Kimmy Schmidt, even though they initially tried to do the more traditional network model. And to that extent, War Machine was also shopped to studios. The idea for the movie has been around for a long time, and it just couldn't get made. And Netflix did allow that to get made because what Netflix will do is, you know, there's a real... well-known sort of hands-off approach to filmmaking from them. There's not a lot of notes that the makers of their movie have to deal with. It's sort of like, here's the money to make your movie and or your TV show, go do it. We're not really going to tell you what to do. And that is something I can appreciate. I think the thing where I sort of get concerned is that, you know, they're throwing so much money around right now. Like, it just doesn't seem sustainable in any way. And there's also, like, I can't imagine Bright, the Will Smith, David Ayer movie that's coming out. Like, that's not going to be a great film. It's just going to be, like, another, like, decent movie that I would have seen on a Tuesday matinee sort of thing, you know? And I just don't see the potential for a lot of, like, maybe greatness in the way that Netflix is making these movies. And I know Scorsese's got a movie coming out with them in a year and a half, and Okja is apparently supposed to be very good. I just don't like that director's previous films all that much. But yeah, I don't know. I just find it interesting or hard to figure out. Sean Fennessy is a writer I really appreciate, and he wrote this thing this week about how will we know when a Netflix movie is actually great, because it just sort of stands so far apart from Hollywood, whereas an Amazon movie like Manchester by the Sea, which won a couple of Oscars, we know that it's great because it went through the traditional channels and was able to get the traditional awards. Also, we saw Manchester by the Sea, and Manchester by the Sea is a very good movie. You know, we used our eyes. And maybe if War Machine was like an unimpeachably great movie, I would feel that way. But I would still be bummed out that I didn't get to see War Machine in a movie theater. You know what I mean? Just because I'm an old man who likes to watch movies the way that people watched them in 1967. You know, it's just I am so confident I would have liked War Machine slightly more if I wasn't watching it in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, yeah, a few things there. I mean, it's hard to argue against Total Freedom for the people making it, right?
No, exactly. How many times have I said, just throw money at Steven Soderbergh, throw money at David Fincher? Netflix did just throw money at David Fincher, and the result was House of Cards. Kind of a letdown, but it was an enjoyable show. Well, I still watched it, but just not up to Fincher standards, right? So, like, I can't disagree with the idea of just throw money at filmmakers who I respect. Yeah,
yeah, and then, so also there's sort of the, it's a bit of a chicken and the egg thing, but everyone's been talking about the middle ground of movies disappearing in Hollywood. You know, it's either a really, really cheap movie or it's a really expensive movie. And by that, I mean a franchise, like a pre-existing IP. You know, we throw $500 million at it and hope to make a billion. And that's, you know, that's a good gamble. And as I said, it's a bit of a chicken and the egg thing. But if Netflix is going to come in and bring that middle ground back, you know, it's hard to look at that as not a positive. And I'm with you. I will say with certainty, not to the same degree, about go and still enjoying going to the movies. I still love it, but we know it's, you know, you're on a whole other plane from the rest of humanity, probably. I still enjoy that communal experience a lot. Like, it's absolutely stupid movie, but I just saw Baywatch, and I love watching Baywatch with a group of people. And unless I had 200 friends to invite to my house to watch Baywatch, I'm not gonna have that experience, right? And part of that is just are you willing to trade off the someone willing to put the money forward to make those middle ground movies if the communal experience is only, you know, talking about it online after the fact? And I think that's a, you know, I'm not necessarily looking for a yes or no, but just the way this movie deals with transitions and good and bad things that come from it, I look at that as the trade-off, the way that I can kind of look at this progression, as usually technology has one good thing and one bad thing, and that communal experience and that monoculture faded, but it also opened things up to more voices and opened up you know, a way to talk to it with more people, and all these movies that wouldn't be made, and all these filmmakers and subcultures and groups of people that just wouldn't have a chance to make something like this ever get their chance to do it, which, again, everything's a trade-off, but you kind of value those things as you choose to.
I think the I kind of feel like Netflix isn't necessarily making middle ground. They're certainly, you know, their movies aren't superhero movies. But
this is a $60 million movie.
That's, yeah, but it's
what we're talking about when we talk about the middle ground disappearing, isn't it?
I sort of picture middle as more like 30 to 40. I view like Amazon, what Amazon is doing. I feel like that is Amazon and Annapurna basically are the only people that are making those types of movies, right? And that's sort of what I view as the model, or the current model of middle ground. I just feel like this movie is too expensive to count as middle ground to me.
Okay, that's
and
fair.
Feels
high
too big.
Middle ground.
Yeah, exactly. So what Netflix is doing is going for even bigger fish than middle ground, I feel like. And so I don't
a Brad Pitt movie partially shot in Afghanistan probably isn't the best example of a middle ground movie.
Exactly.
It
And so I don't know. I don't know. I just feel like Netflix, with what they've done for movies right now, to this point, and what has been announced for the future, like, I just don't think it's middle ground what they're doing. I think it is slightly, you know, it's like up the upper middle class of movies, you know, like, whereas Amazon's still doing the middle class, right? Like, The Lost City of Zed is a movie we both saw and both liked. That was an Amazon.
What's more middle class than Manchester by the Sea? Of a janitor in Boston,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So yeah, I don't know. It's just, the new world frightens and confuses me, James.
Okay.
I am General Glenn McMahon of the movie theaters, sitting there with my clawed hand trying to hold on to what life used to be like.
All right, we'll do Birth of a Nation next week. such an easier old man suffering.
Yeah, and I mean, like, part of it, like, part of this is to be blamed on us. Like, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, and I'm sure you do as well, where the release window for between theaters and the video store was almost a full year a lot of the time. And then, you know, Ray famously sort of sped it up to like a 6-week release window, because Ray was released on video 6 weeks after it hit theaters because they thought that would help Jamie Foxx get an Oscar. Whether or not it did, who knows? He did get the Oscar, so it certainly didn't hurt. And then, you know, since then, the release window has only gotten smaller to the point where it's non-existent for some movies now. And, you know, and that just sort of... on as a whole, that sort of just speeds up the amount of time we get to have this movie like in our consciousness, you know. And now that amount of time with War Machine is non-existent, you know. Like, this movie just feels like less because it's on Netflix to me, you know. And just the way the amount, and admittedly part of that is because it doesn't have $50 million of advertising money putting it on the like bus stops that, you know, that people just have to see, despite the fact that advertising annoys us, you know. So I don't know, it just sort of, the closing of the release window is also the closing of the amount of time the movie stays in culture's consciousness, and I suppose that's the real issue for me. Yeah.
Yep, I get that.
Yep. All right. Thank you for listening to two old men telling Netflix to get off their lawn. We'll be back next week talking about how things used to be and why they were better.